From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, selling the family farm to make a record, we talk with Freddie Johnston. The album he made with the money from the farm has been called a perfect album, and it ended up on a lot of last year's 10 best lists. We'll hear some of his recorded music, and he'll also perform for us. Also today, Struck by Lightning, we talk with Gretel Ehrlich about the bolt of lightning that stopped her heart, altered her central nervous system, and left her hovering between life and death. Her memoir about the experience and its aftermath is called A Match to the Heart. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD collection of music by Fletcher Henderson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A powerful earthquake rocked Northern California and Southern Oregon today, but no injuries are reported. The U.S. Geological Survey in Boulder, Colorado, measures the quake at 7.2 on the Richter scale. Spokesman Waverly Person at the Earthquake Information Center in Boulder says the earthquake was centered in the Pacific Ocean, about 90 miles off the coast, and he says that large underwater earthquakes of this sort are not unusual.
Back in 1992, we had three earthquakes, and one of them being up to 7.1, and we didn't have any wave activity from that. We had a little bit of local activity, so it's not unusual to have that. We could have aftershocks for days to come. That's usual for an earthquake of this size.
Police say the only serious damage reported so far has been a house knocked off its foundation in a rural area near Fortuna. A Los Angeles judge has held in contempt of court a mystery witness in the O.J. Simpson case. The lawyer for a man identified as John Dunton argued in court that the witness has refused to testify before a grand jury investigating the case because he's afraid his life is in danger. The lawyer emphasizes that the witness is not afraid of Simpson, nor of Simpson's friend Al Cowlings. The lawyer says his client's information is not firsthand and is remote from the subject of the murders of Simpson's ex-wife and her friend. The U.S. and Cuba have opened talks on the refugee crisis. The discussions, taking place in New York, are aimed at getting the emigrants, many using flimsy rafts, off the water. The U.S. agreed to the talks after more than 16,000 Cubans headed for Florida in the space of a month. Many are being detained at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. The Clinton administration says it wants a safe and orderly migration process. Attorney General Janet Reno emphasized that point again today. UPI's Bill Small reports.
The message from Attorney General Janet Reno to potential Cuban rafters and to those already picked up and taken to the Guantanamo Naval Base remains blunt. To get to the United States, get in line at the U.S. intersection in Havana.
We want to do everything we can to ensure legal immigration. Those in Guantanamo will not come to the United States from Guantanamo, but they will be the processes in Cuba will be available to them.
The U.S. currently takes in only about 3,000 Cubans a year that way. There have been reports the U.S. may increase that number to more than 20,000, but Reno won't say whether that's true. Bill Small, Washington.
Construction spending was up in July for the fifth straight month. The government reports an increase of 0.6 points driven by government spending. Higher mortgage rates have reduced demand for residential projects, and residential construction fell 1%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 15 points. The NASDAQ Composite Index is down more than 6 points. This is NPR. A UN aid official accused Bosnian Serb leaders of terrorism today. Peter Kessler of the UN's main refugee office says in August alone, 3,000 Bosnian Muslims were driven from their homes in Serb-held areas. Kessler says movements of that size can only have happened with the full support of the Bosnian Serb authorities. He calls the operation state-ordained terrorism. Bosnian Serb leaders often have distanced themselves from ethnic cleansing campaigns, blaming them on local officials whom they say they can't control. Morocco has become the second Arab country after Egypt to establish formal relations with Israel. The BBC's Alfred Hermida reports.
The decision by Morocco to open relations with Israel has been in the wind for some time. For years, Morocco's ruler, King Hassan, has played a role behind the scenes in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Despite the lack of diplomatic relations, leading Israeli politicians have made discreet visits to Morocco in the past. The secret diplomacy came out into the open a year ago, when the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and his Foreign Minister Shimon Peres publicly visited the king in Rabat after signing the peace accord with the PLO in Washington. Over the past few weeks, the two sides have been putting the finishing touches to an agreement on formal diplomatic relations. That accord has now been made public, with Morocco announcing it's opening a liaison office in Tel Aviv and allowing Israel to do the same in Rabat.
Alfred Hermida reporting. Ireland is sending Deputy Prime Minister Dick Spring to visit President Clinton on Martha's Vineyard tomorrow to press for more aid to cement moves toward peace in Northern Ireland. But Senator Patrick Leahy, who chairs a subcommittee that would deal with such funds, says Congress won't get to the request this year. Six people died in Taiwan today as Typhoon Gladys slammed into the island. One man died in a flooded river. Others were killed by falling objects. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Singer-songwriter Freddie Johnston has a new album called This Perfect World. His music has been showered with praise. A review in the New York Times said Johnston writes beautifully constructed pop songs. Johnston's previous album, Can You Fly, ended up on our rock critic Ken Tucker's top 10 list, as well as on lists in the New York Times, Spin, and People. Critic Robert Christgau called it a perfect album, a study in bringing confusion under control and in loving your life as a beautiful mess. Last summer, we invited Johnston to talk with us from the NPR Bureau in New York, and to our surprise, he brought his guitar. But before he played, we started with one of his recordings. This is The Lucky One, featured on his album Can You Fly?
Walking from the bus stop,
Justin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. Thanks for having me.
Who is this song about?
The Lucky One is, it's not about any one person. It was inspired by a trip I took to Las Vegas a couple years ago. It showed up about midnight or 1 a.m. on this hot summer night and saw all these guys walking to and from the downtown casinos. Just, you know, I don't know. I didn't expect to see that, these sort of walking dead zombies going from one slot machine bank to the next. And it was very sad.
Well, here's what I was wondering, that, you know, when you left your home and went to New York and hoped to make it as a songwriter, I bet a lot of people said to you, oh, no, only the lucky ones make it, and very few people make it. And you'll
well,
make
now
it.
That's a very interesting angle on that. I've never thought about that at all. But that's true. And I'm sure that I said that to myself many times.
That you know that, you'd be the lucky one?
No, that a lot of people make it, and that, you know, fat chance, kid. But I've never put that spin on that song.
You grew up in a small town named Kinsley, Kansas. Would you describe the town for us?
Well, it's a small town, about 2,500 people out on the western Kansas prairie. There's not a lot going on there. There's one movie theater. At least last time I was there, there was a movie theater and a couple bars. But no real, I guess, I don't know. It's not the cultural center of the world or even of Kansas. So it was a little slow. I ended up driving around in my friend's car since I didn't drive. Driving around with my friends when I was an adolescent, just listening to tapes and causing trouble. That was my life there.
What kind of tapes and what kind of trouble?
Next question. No, I listen to a lot of mid-70s heavy metal. To be honest, it doesn't completely come through in my music.
It sure doesn't
at all. But I'm still a pretty big Led Zeppelin fan and Aerosmith and Cheap Trick and all that stuff. Those are my roots, Terry. It seems to me, David Bowie. It was only later when I started listening to different kinds of music. And now I listen to everything.
How come you seem to be in the singer-songwriter tradition of rock, and your musical listening roots are in the heavy metal tradition?
Well, I've thought about that a bit, obviously, because it is pretty strange. I guess it comes from playing acoustic guitar. I bought an acoustic guitar when I was 16. I ordered it through UPS from some distributor on the East Coast, because there wasn't a music store in town. But when I started playing acoustic guitar, you just end up writing folky type music because of the nature of the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't very well do heavy metal ballads on my acoustic guitar. So I think it comes from me playing acoustic guitar. It's the influence of the instrument more so than the music.
You have your guitar with you.
Yeah, I do.
Would you play us a chorus of something that was very important to you when you first started to play?
When I first started to play?
Yeah.
Well, I could completely humiliate myself and play you a bit of a joke song that I first wrote.
Please.
Do you really want to hear that?
Yes.
This is not a joke program, but when I was 18, there was a senior class talent show, and I wrote a song for that. It ended up being kind of a kid's song, but it was the first song I ever wrote. And it's called Sparky the Heroic Dog. Do you want to hear a little bit of that?
Absolutely.
Sparky the Heroic Dog, save my life one night when the house burned down. Sparky the Heroic Dog became a hero back in my hometown. Oh, Sparky. And there's a sad part. Do you want to hear that too?
Sure.
Sparky, my dog, was so warm and soft and brought my pipe and slippers when I came home from work each night. You can tell I was just learning how to write songs. I had too many words in that line. He smelled when he was wet, but I loved Sparky yet. A primitive rhyme. Sparky. There you go.
What kind of reaction did you get at the talent contest?
It was uproarious because there were a lot of kids in the audience. So the kids loved it. But that was, I guess, I have no self-respect whatsoever. There it is. That's because I just did that on National Public Radio, Terry. But that's the first song I ever wrote. It's not really my roots or where I come from, but it is the first song I ever wrote.
Let me get back to something you were saying earlier. You said that you would drive around in friends' cars listening to tapes and getting into trouble. So now we should get to the trouble part.
Well, there wasn't a lot to do. You would basically kind of drive around in a circle from Main Street back up to the highway and then around. It was a circuit of town, and that's kind of what you would do for fun. It's a pretty limited, fairly limited options of what to do in Kinsley, Kansas when you're a kid. But I didn't cause that much trouble, I guess. I lived in a smaller town. It's too complicated of a story to get into, but I lived in a smaller town nearby for a time, and that's when I got into trouble. An even smaller town of 100 people.
Trouble for doing what?
Just, there's nothing to do there, and you turn into a vandal. I say one turns into a vandal. And
that's absolving yourself of responsibility.
I don't know, just causing trouble. And, in retrospect, it's not completely, I wasn't a felon or anything. It was out of frustration or out of boredom is what it was.
My guest is singer-songwriter Freddie Johnston. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with singer-songwriter Freddy Johnston. Freddy, how did you get out of Kansas and go to New York?
How did I get out? Well, one night, one dark night when the moon was down, I dug a hole under the fence and took a handkerchief with a pocket knife and some dried bread and ran for the border. But in reality, no, I actually took the bus from Lawrence, Kansas one day and came to New York City and moved in with a friend who had a spare couch and started, this is about in 85, 86, and started looking for a job and I guess starting over.
How did you try to get people to hear your songs in New York? I'm assuming that you already had the idea that you wanted to record.
Well, I was fairly unambitious, I guess. It took me a long time to play my songs for anyone. And even after that, I didn't actively promote myself or try to get a band together. When I look back, I wish I had done that. That's the way to go. It didn't happen that way for me. But that's a reason why, perhaps about why it took me so long.
So
I'm now 32, and I guess I've been writing songs for about 10 years. So it's taken me a while. But when I came here, I didn't get a band together. I just worked with my 4-track in my apartment, and it took the intervention of friends to get me to do it, to distribute a tape and things like that.
Did you try to perform in clubs?
I only performed here after I had a record deal with Barn & Records.
That's odd, because it's usually the other way around. You perform clubs, where you live, and try to get some other gigs nearby, and then finally somebody hears you and you get a record. But you usually have a lot of performing under your belt by the time you've recorded.
You usually do. I went about it completely backwards. I'm lucky that I was able to get up on stage and wasn't afraid to make a fool of myself or be a ham. So I didn't have a lot of trouble. I had done half a dozen gigs or so before The Trouble Tree came out, my first record, so I wasn't a seasoned road dog at all, but I was able to play, I was able to bring it across.
How did you get a tape to the record company Bar None that first signed you?
I actually didn't do it. It was a friend of mine, a writer friend named Michael Azarad. He heard a tape, actually through his wife, who worked with my cousin at the New Yorker magazine. It's a long story, but she had a tape and gave it to him, and then he liked it and began distributing it. And one day Barnum called me up, and the rest is the rest.
So if somebody hadn't taken action on your behalf, maybe nothing would have happened.
I don't know if it would have happened at that rate. No, I fully admit that. I was not promoting myself.
For someone who's been pretty unambitious and not at all into selling himself, especially when you were first getting started, you did something that I think really indicates a great kind of belief in your music. And what I'm thinking of is when you sold the family farm to raise money to finish production on your first album.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what happened.
I don't like to admit it, even though I end up talking about it all the time. I don't like to really use it as a promotional tool, that topic, because it still bothers me that I had to do that. It was the right decision. I don't regret it, but it was a difficult one. It was inherited farmland, inherited from my grandfather, and it was my only real asset at the time of making the album, and we ran out of cash. The record company ran out of cash, and yet the record had to be finished. So I liquidated the land, and the gamble paid off. But I guess getting back to the lucky one there, the gamble paid off. Had it not paid off, I don't know where I would be. I don't know where I'd... it's not that I don't know where I'd be, but I don't know how I'd be feeling right now. I would probably be very depressed if I had sold that precious land and then the record had been panned or slagged or ignored or not even come out. So I rolled the dice and won, and I'm not really a gambling person. I when I went to Las Vegas, I gambled $1.50. So it's not in my nature to do that. Someday there's I have a dream of buying back the land. Mm-hmm. I know the man who bought it fairly well, so that is a possibility. The problem with selling the land mainly was that it contained the house that I had lived in the first house I lived in. So I didn't want to sell that. And at least, I think, I could buy back the house someday to make up for it. That would actually be a fitting conclusion to the story, selling the land and then enabling me to eventually buy it back. But that's the story. And the first song on the album kind of is about that.
Yeah, why don't we play that? The song is called Trying to Tell You I Don't Know. And do you want to say something about when you wrote this and how you wrote it?
Well, it was written, one of the last songs when we were making the album. It was one of the last songs that I finished. It was an angry song, and I hadn't intended it to be part of the record, but it ended up making it. And it's ironic that it's a song about the making of the record.
Why don't we hear it? Trying to Tell You I Don't Know, Freddie Johnston, and it's from his album Can You Fly. How did the rest of your family react when you sold the farm?
It was kind of a secret for a while. I was ashamed. It was my decision. It was my brother and I jointly owned the land, so it was our decision. But I didn't want to talk about it. I still haven't really. I honestly haven't spoken to my mother about it directly. It's an open. I mean, it's a known topic, but I've kept it to myself. I just don't like to talk about it to them, because I think that if my grandfather would have been alive, or my father had been alive to see me commit that act, it would have just been unbelievable to them. The height of folly to sell this thing that you can see and measure and use and that is producing a yearly income from a wheat crop, this real estate, to sell that to finish making a rock record that maybe or maybe not is gonna maybe do something, possibly, perhaps. they wouldn't have been able to believe it.
Can I ask you about your name, Freddie? That's a nickname?
It's a nickname, actually. It's I streamlined the story that my mother gave it to me. It's actually a friend of my mother's named Leela, gave me the name years ago when I was about, I don't know, 14 or 15. It was a mispronunciation of Freddie. And my mother made the name happen. She just, she wouldn't let it go. She called me Freddie all the time because she thought it was so hilarious. And she still calls me Freddie. She calls me Freed, actually.
There was a bar in the place you grew up called the Trouble Tree.
The Trouble Tree, yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us about the bar and play a chorus of the song you wrote about it?
Really? Okay. The Trouble Tree, that was named by my mother as well, just like I was. It's closed now, sadly. But it was called the Rain Tree Lounge, and it was a little bar downtown. It was actually, the Kansas alcohol laws have changed since, but it used to be that in order to sell hard liquor, you had to be a private club, and you had to be a member to go in there. Anyway, this was a private club, and it was on the weekend nights, all hell would break loose. I don't know why, but my mother renamed it from the Rain Tree to the Trouble Tree, and I wrote a little ditty about it. Which I never played for my mother because I was so embarrassed, but she eventually heard it. Do you want to hear a little of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Thank you. up in the trouble tree, drinking with Leela's ex, up in the trouble tree, fighting with Mexicans. Never been to New York, got a brother in Galveston. Been to the trouble tree, up there more than once. I'm shaking like a leaf. He looks like a very bad fruit. He's rotten through with grief, falling out of the trouble tree. Not the best take there, but...
Well, I thought it sounded really good.
Okay. I've always worried about the line about fighting with Mexicans. I don't want that to be misinterpreted. That's just kind of what happened. A lot of farm workers from Mexico would come up, as far as Kansas, obviously, and they would be drinking on a weekend night, and there would be scuffles just all the time. It was kind of comical in a way, although I'm sure to be involved in them, it wasn't comical. And then the Leela's ex line, I might as well, since I'm on national radio, that was the woman, Leela, who actually gave me my nickname, her ex-husband, put on the front of his pickup in big stick-on letters after he divorced her, Leela's ex. And so you'd always see that truck sitting down at the trouble tree. And, it's just too much.
Freddy Johnston recorded last summer. He has a new album called This Perfect World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is a song called Bad Reputation from Johnston's new album.
I know I got a bad reputation, and it isn't just talk, talk, talk. If I could only give you everything, you know I haven't got. I couldn't have one conversation if it wasn't for the lies, lies, lies. And still I wanna tell you everything till I close my eyes. Suddenly I'm on the street, 7 years disappeared.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Three summers ago, while walking on the Wyoming plains in a storm, Gretel Ehrlich was struck by lightning. The force of it threw her 40 feet, severely damaged her nervous system, and nearly killed her. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll talk with Ehrlich about the psychological and physical aftermath. It's the subject of her memoir, A Match to the Heart. The music of the great bandleader and pianist Fletcher Henderson has been collected on a new set of CDs. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A strong earthquake was felt along the Pacific coast today from southern Oregon to the San Francisco area. The National Earthquake Information Center says the quake measured 7.2 on the Richter scale. The earthquake was centered about 90 miles off the coast, some 250 miles northwest of San Francisco. No injuries are reported. The only damage report in so far is a house in Fortuna sliding off its foundation. The last major wildfire burning in Washington state has been declared fully contained. Bill Radke of member station KUOW reports.
After more than a month of work, 81 miles of defensible fire lines have been drawn around the Hatchery Creek complex of fires. Because of the size of the fires and the steep, remote terrain, the complex isn't expected to be controlled until the end of October. The seven fires in the complex have burned a total of 43,000 acres on the east slopes of the Cascade Mountains, near a Bavarian-themed tourist town called Leavenworth. Most of the Hatchery Creek fires were sparked by lightning in July, but the biggest of the fires was started accidentally by a human. That blaze burned 24,000 acres and 19 homes. It's been an unusually bad fire season in Washington. More than 200,000 acres have burned, at least 37 homes or cabins are gone, and the total cost of firefighting could reach $100 million. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke reporting.
Nebraska is set to carry out its first execution in 35 years, barring further court action. Keith Ludden of Nebraska Public Radio reports.
Nebraska's electric chair has not been used since 1959, when Charles Starkweather was put to death for a murder spree that took 11 lives. Just after midnight tonight, Harold Lamont Otte is scheduled to die in the electric chair for the 1977 rape and murder of an Omaha college student. Otte's lawyers have waged a 16-year battle to keep him out of the electric chair. Recent legal appeals for Otte have focused on racial bias and what his lawyers say was a flawed clemency hearing in 1991. At that hearing, Nebraska Attorney General Don Stenberg sat on the three-member state board of pardons while members of his staff presented a case for denying clemency. Nebraska Governor Ben Nelson joined Stenberg in voting not to commute the death sentence to life in prison and says he does not intend to change his vote. For National Public Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska, I'm Keith Ludden.
A federal judge has given final approval to the largest single product liability settlement in U.S. history. It's a $4.25 billion agreement between breast implant makers and women who say the devices compromise their health. Critics say the fund is too small for all the women seeking compensation. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials fell almost 12 points to close at 3901.44. Declining issues led advances 2-1. This is NPR. Morocco has become the second Arab country after Egypt to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. The new ties are low-level, with liaison offices being established in Tel Aviv and Rabat, the Moroccan capital. Morocco says it will simultaneously open a liaison office with the new PLO administration in the Gaza Strip. Israel had hoped Morocco and other moderate Arab states like Tunisia would quickly establish ties after Israel signed a peace agreement with the PLO last September. A consumer group says rental car companies are overcharging customers by selling them accident insurance that duplicates coverage most people already have. Bill Wood of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group says the item in question is the collision damage waiver.
A report found that many consumers do not need to purchase CDW because they are already covered by their personal auto insurance or by their credit card. Even for consumers who don't own cars, and thus don't have personal auto insurance, credit cards like American Express and the gold card versions of MasterCard and Visa often provide insurance coverage for car rentals.
The group says only half of the rental car agents mentioned the possible duplication, even when the group's investigator posing as a customer asked, "What happens if I get hit by someone?" The report says the additional insurance adds about $11 a day to the average rental, and that agents rarely mention it when consumers are price shopping over the phone. The American Rental Car Association, the main industry group, says U.S. PIRG is overstating the problem and ignoring the legitimate need some customers have for the insurance. Scientists are not trying to straighten the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but they are trying to stop it from tilting further. An engineer who leads a team trying to save the tower said today that he wants to support the structure with thick steel cables buried deep underground. That would be a temporary solution until something more permanent is devised. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I was recently caught in an awful thunderstorm while driving on the expressway. As I inched along in my car, watching some vivid lightning, I thought about Gretel Ehrlich. She was struck by lightning on her Wyoming ranch during a storm 3 summers ago. She was knocked unconscious and nearly died. Her new memoir, A Match to the Heart, chronicles the physical, psychological, and emotional aftereffects of the electric current that passed through her body. Ehrlich now lives in California, where she grew up. She's best known for her essays and short stories about life in Wyoming, where she lived for much of the 70s and 80s, herding sheep and cattle. Her books include The Solace of Open Spaces and Islands, Universe, Home. We spoke earlier this summer, and I asked her to read from the opening of her new book, A Match to the Heart.
I woke in a pool of blood lying on my stomach some distance from where I should have been, flung at an odd angle to one side of the dirt path. The whole sky had grown dark. Was it evening, and if so, which one? How many minutes or hours had elapsed since I lost consciousness, and where were the dogs? I tried to call out to them, but my voice didn't work. The muscles in my throat were paralyzed, and I couldn't swallow. Were the dogs dead? Everything was terribly wrong. I had trouble seeing, talking, breathing, and I couldn't move my legs or right arm. Nothing remained in my memory. No sounds, flashes, smells, no warnings of any kind. Had I been shot in the back? Had I suffered a stroke or a heart attack? These thoughts were dark pools in sand. The sky was black. Was this a storm in the middle of the day, or was it night with a storm traveling through? When thunder exploded over me, I knew I had been hit by lightning.
Gretel Ehrlich, how did you know you were hit by lightning?
Well, I didn't at first. It was really just after I'd been lying there for a while, and I at first thought I was going to die, and then I didn't die. And then this storm kind of circled around and came over the mountain and really pounded hard, and there was lightning everywhere. And then it finally occurred to me that that's what must have happened to me.
And why did you think that? I know, sure, there was a storm, but why did you think that that made sense, that what you were experiencing was the symptoms of being hit by lightning?
Well, I was paralyzed, although at first I thought maybe I'd been shot in the back, but paralysis comes when you're hit by lightning because your muscles contract so violently. And I had crushing chest pains, but, I really didn't think I was a heart attack victim. So I just thought that must have been it.
You woke up in a pool of blood. Where was the blood coming from?
My head. When you're hit by lightning, this is the only thing I wish I had seen happen. Your muscles contract so violently that you literally fly through the air. So, you know, like a big explosion. So I flew somewhere. It's like the flying nun. So I just hit my head on some rocks, and I had some cuts on my face. And, you know, they bleed more than is really... I mean, I wasn't injured very badly, but there was a lot of blood around.
When you awoke, you couldn't tell if you were dead or alive for a moment there?
Well, I thought I was dead, but if I was dead, how did I know I was dead? So I guess that meant I was alive.
Would you describe the feeling of feeling in between?
Yeah, it's this kind of gray area, not very attractive, not... You know, you keep hearing these stories of this great sense of peace comes over you, and I didn't feel any peace at all. I just felt that I was someplace that had no juiciness, no vividness, no brightness, no vitality left to it. It had all been stripped away. And I had no self, in a way, no identity and no volition. And it was a very oppressive feeling.
You did manage to summon up enough strength and willpower to get yourself back to your house, which is about a quarter of a mile away from where you were struck by lightning.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been awfully hard to do.
Well, I was lying there for a while and thinking I was going to die, so I was trying to clear my mind and just, you know, not be panicky and let it happen. And then it didn't happen, and then I got mad. I thought, oh, now I have to go get help, which seemed like a much worse prospect at the moment. But I did. I knew, you know, if I stayed out there, I was probably going to die of exposure, because by then it was raining hard, it was getting cold, and nobody would ever, you know, nobody would have found me for maybe days, weeks, months. So I knew I had to do something. There was really no choice unless I actually chose to die, which suddenly I didn't want to do. So I just got up.
Well, you had a couple of bad hospital experiences early on where equipment didn't work and the doctors really didn't know what to do with you. But then you went to a larger hospital and had a cardiologist who became, I think, a friend as well as a doctor. What did you learn about the body's electrochemical operation and how that's affected by the disruption of lightning?
Yeah, well, in my case, I had a brainstem injury, which affects the autonomic nervous system and my sympathetic nervous system, which is the part that sort of gives your body the get up and go. It tells your heart to beat. It controls blood pressure. It releases the neurotransmitters that tell the blood vessels to constrict or not to constrict. That whole operation was completely fried, and just didn't work. So I just my heart kept beating because, you know, it has this internal pacemaker, a kind of natural pacemaker that makes the heart want to beat. But that was about all that was keeping me going. So I learned a lot about, I mean, that you can't learn anything about the body without also thinking about the brain and the chemical architecture of the brain. So I did a lot of reading in both areas.
Would you mind just doing a quick inventory for us about how different parts of your body were affected by the lightning?
Yeah, well, at first I was paralyzed from the waist down and down my right arm, and my throat was paralyzed, my throat muscles, so I couldn't swallow or talk. So then I had, you know, external bruises and cuts and things. But then the interior effects were just the whole sympathetic nervous system. They say that when lightning enters you, you have sympathetic storms. It's like really ingesting a whole storm in your body. And it literally burned the passageways through which the brain, the neurotransmitters, which are little drops of chemicals, it destroyed those highways in my body, so that all those cells had to, they think cells are covered with this kind of sheath that protects it, and they think that actually melted. So all of that had to be repaired.
My guest is Gretel Ehrlich. Her new memoir, A Match to the Heart, is about being struck by lightning. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gretel Ehrlich. We all know the expression, lightning never strikes twice in the same place. But in fact, you were hit twice by lightning, which is really shocking to me. The first time, I think it wasn't a direct hit. You were riding on a horse and the horse was hit?
Yeah, it was lightning that was coming across a little meadow at a very high altitude, just going across the ground, and it came up through my horse's legs and up through my legs. You know, the horse had shoes on and I had spurs on, and this big spark bounced off the top of my head. But that's, you know, that's all that happened.
What do you make of it that you were struck twice?
Oh, well, a lot of people have been struck twice. I'm outside a lot, you know, really much more than a lot of people. But, you know, ranchers, farmers, fishermen, people like that are golfers, often get struck more than once. I think Lee Trevino's been struck a couple of times. And so it's just really an occupational hazard, especially if you live in a mountainous area, you know, where there's afternoon thunderstorms or say, like Florida has a lot of lightning strikes.
So you think it has more to do with people who are out in big open spaces during storms.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't feel like you were
all day.
So you didn't feel like you were being targeted by the forces of nature.
Oh, not at all. Quite the opposite. I just think it's part of, you know, living in the natural world. Things happen to you.
After you were struck by lightning, you were sick for months afterwards, and you needed someone to take care of you. For a while, your parents took care of you. And your parents, when you were hit, were 75. What did it feel like to be their child again, to be taken care of by them again?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I hadn't spent a whole lot of time with my parents for a very long time. And when I called them from Wyoming and said I needed help and I didn't think I was going to make it through the night, and my father said, I'll be there in 4 hours, and went and found a friend who had a plane and came and got me, and I ended up on the cardiac care unit, and then was released to their house after a week in intensive care. And you know what happened was, I mean, they were in the room when my heart was almost stopped beating and I had no blood pressure. And when they got me going again and I opened my eyes, I couldn't talk or move, but my mother was stroking my arm, and we just looked at each other, and at that moment, any of the problems or whatever that goes on between parents and children for many years just really went away. And ever since then, we've been very, very close. And, you know, in a certain way, they were the only people in the world besides my doctor who I knew would understand when I really needed help, even if I was unable to tell them. I mean, because they know me so well, they could just look at my face and know, and were really available to help me. So it was quite wonderful, and it engendered a new friendship between us, which has been great for both of us. And so now we take turns taking care of each other. Now they're almost 80, and they need some help, and sometimes I need some help. So it's been really good.
So you live near each other now?
Well, I now live about 50 miles away, but near enough.
That's pretty close by modern standards.
Yeah.
You went to a conference for people who've been struck by lightning. It's called the Lightning Strike and Electric Shock Conference. I believe it was founded in 1989 by a man who had been struck by lightning. Were there things that surprised you that other people experienced that you'd experienced too?
Yeah, it was quite comforting to find that there was a sameness in some of the less tangible problems that I was having. Things that, you know, my cardiologist couldn't figure out, which was lots of chest pain, but no apparent reason for it, and lots of kind of random pain, lots of really deep fatigue, you know, unlike anything I've ever experienced before. So, and it turns out that everybody has those same problems, and it was quite common. And the neurologist that was there, explained sort of what he felt was going on. And so, in that way, it was quite interesting. And you know, it was sort of interesting talking to other people who had been hit by lightning, and it also involved people who've been electrocuted somehow, like linemen and you know, people who hit a light switch that's not grounded properly. And actually, their injuries are much more serious in general.
Why are they more serious than lightning?
Well, usually because it's the electricity, it stays in your body longer. Say a lineman who gets stuck on a transformer, you know, sometimes they're up there for minutes and minutes and minutes, and it's very, very damaging. Also, they remember it. See, anyone hit directly by lightning doesn't remember it, and so I was spared that trauma of remembering what I'm sure is very painful. And the electrocuted people remember everything, and they have a lot of psychological damage that they have to deal with. So,
you know, most of your writing in the past has been about nature, about open spaces, about living in Wyoming, about place and geography and so on. And it seems to me in your new book you're looking at your body and the body in general with the same kind of awe that you used to examine the landscape with.
Yeah, well, you know, what I discovered is the body is this great ecosystem all in itself. And I mean, it is really a miraculous place. Our bodies themselves are more complex than our imaginations. So I think it's, it was really like a whole nother landscape, or I call it an organscape.
Gretel Ehrlich, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gretel Ehrlich's new memoir is called A Match to the Heart. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Cuba?
Well, we hear from Tom Jelton in Havana today about who is setting out in rafts now for a destination that will end up most likely being Guantanamo. They are young men, he says, men in their 20s, without families, and evidently without any prospects in Castro's Cuba. Also, a report from Miami on what Cubans there are hearing and saying on radio about the migrants. We'll also tonight have a special piece, a production of readings, a reading from Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, and also news of new trends in employment and unemployment in the U.S.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the great jazz big bands in the 1920s was led by pianist Fletcher Henderson. It was the first band Louis Armstrong played with in New York, and the one in which Coleman Hawkins emerged as jazz's first great tenor saxophonist. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new CD collection of music by Fletcher Henderson, including this recording, Henderson's 1936 hit Christopher Columbus.
The 3-CD box, The Fletcher Henderson Story, A Study in Frustration, is a reissue of a 4-LP set Columbia Records issued back during the Kennedy administration. For many years, that box was the introduction to Henderson's music. But eventually, it went out of print, and it wasn't issued on CD till now. That's a little like letting Hemingway's short stories go out of print for decades. As even casual jazz fans should know, Henderson's band did a lot to popularize the basic strategy for big band jazz writing, with brass and reeds deployed in opposing sections. Now, separating brass and reeds had already been an established custom in dance bands, but Henderson's sections really egged each other on rhythmically, like the individual horns in a Dixieland group. This is the end of Tozo from 1927, arranged by Don Redman. That's Fletcher Henderson on piano. Some folks insist jazz has to swing all the time, as if the music aspired to no more than foot-tapping status. But jazz had been around for more than two decades before swinging rhythm became remotely common. Trumpeter Louis Armstrong introduced swing to Henderson's band when he joined up for a year starting in 1924. The rhythm section was pretty stiff then, but that didn't bother Armstrong. You can hear that for yourself on Everybody Loves My Baby. Armstrong's brief tenure aside, Henderson's greatest soloist was tenor sax pioneer and occasional composer Coleman Hawkins. His tune Queer Notions, arranged by Fletcher's brother Horace Henderson, made use of dissonant chords built on whole tone scales. Pretty wacky stuff for jazz back then. This is the sound of the avant-garde, 1933. Later in the 1930s, America heard Fletcher Henderson's music secondhand when Benny Goodman hired him as a staff arranger. Oddly enough, the next big band leader to champion Henderson was the futuristic pianist Sun Ra, who'd worked with Henderson briefly in the 1940s. 30 years after that, Sun Ra began playing a handful of Henderson classics, Queer Notions included. Now, anyone Benny Goodman and Sun Ra both admire must be worthy of your attention. If you want to be culturally literate, you have to know about Fletcher Henderson.
Kevin Whitehead writes for CD Review, Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.